morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to journalist and photographer Zaylee Pollan, who is going to be talking to us about what's on her mind today on the fifth anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. And we're also going to be speaking to the folks from Global Dance Fest in Albuquerque. Right now, we have sitting around the table with us three of the Arden Players who are producing Macbeth, Shakespeare's Macbeth. Deborah Dennison is the director and Lady Macbeth. Cedar Brosh is Malcolm, and Argus McCallum is Macbeth himself. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen.
Hi.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
So, Deborah, do you do Shakespeare every year? Is it always a Shakespeare play that you do?
Well, we have so far. We've done three Shakespeare plays. This is our third. The future remains to be decided.
So why Macbeth? Why now?
Well, a number of things. First of all, it's a fabulous play and one that a lot of actors told me they'd love to do. The other reason is I think it's relevant. We're dealing in Macbeth with a warrior society that brutalizes its people. In Macbeth you see, I think, the result of that brutalization. It is quite a violent play.
It certainly is. It's a bloodbath.
Yes, I'm afraid it is. But I think we're dealing with those issues today. I know that a number of
productions... On the fifth anniversary of this...
Well, quite. I think it's quite appropriate that we're doing both these things this morning. A number of productions in recent years have set the play in the 1930s in fascist governments. I don't think you need to do that. I think the parallel with this minute is as clear as it could possibly be.
So when you produce a play like Macbeth, there's always the choice of whether to modernize it a little bit in terms of costumes. I went to the rehearsal last night. Of course, everybody looked like a lumberjack.
Because we had no costumes last night.
You didn't have your costumes yet. So how are you going to produce it?
We're doing it 11th century Scotland.
You are?
Yes. We're doing it strictly medieval, and we're using medieval Icelandic music, which is, I think, quite wonderful. And we're having some Gaelic singing in it, which is also...
Medieval old. Icelandic music, did
yes,
you say?
Yes.
How interesting.
Yeah. I think that to set it in the time in which it was historically set, sets it apart, but also makes it relevant to all times. And therefore, we're not pigeonholing it. It's open for all interpretation.
What do we know about how Shakespeare chose this material?
Well, we know that he got the material from historical documents, mainly Holinshed, and we also know that he changed it. The actual history, Macbeth was quite a noble and loved king, and was not did not brutalize his people. In fact, Duncan was a young man, not an old man, and was quite disliked. And Macbeth reigned for some years. Lady Macbeth, his wife, was also loved. So this is essentially a lie historically, but it's a wonderful story. This was a time of transition. Shakespeare wrote this at the beginning of the reign of James I, who was a Scottish king, who came to England to succeed Elizabeth I. And the whole issue of succession, the issue of James I's ancestors, which is one of the reasons that Shakespeare changed the history so he could be politically correct for his king. James I was a very erudite king and loved the theater. He was, in fact, more of a patron of the theater than Elizabeth was. And the great tragedies were written under James. I think it was a combination of the politics of the time and choosing a very good story.
So Macbeth is opening on the 28th of March at El Museo Cultural and will run on weekends through the Sunday, April 13th. It's three weekends.
Yes.
Let's talk about some of the big themes in this play. Argus, you have to play this character who is on some level manipulated by his wife, on some level crazily ambitious.
Well, he's ambitious because it was a very vertically oriented society. If you weren't the king, there was a possibility that you would fall into favor or fall out of favor very quickly, which might also include losing your life. But other than that, I think Macbeth has been played lately, especially in the movies and recent productions, as a very evil, bloodthirsty type of person. And that kind of goes with the kind of a black and white society that we have at the moment. We have this great battle between good and evil. And
or we have it framed that way, whether it is or
exactly.
isn't.
Exactly. And so I believe there are enough clues in the play that show that Macbeth himself, or the way Shakespeare wrote him, is a very conscientious person. He does have a conscience. He believes he's been with the witches telling him that he should be king, he should be the Thane of Cawdor. He takes that, he interprets that in his mind as a green light to take down Duncan, who has not necessarily been a great king. There are indications in the play that he's not the great king that he's thought to be. But once Macbeth starts on this mission, so to speak, he's unable to stop himself, because he has a line, it will have blood, they say, blood will have blood. And he's fully aware of the fact that he is on a slippery slope. And that's what makes it a great tragedy. That's really the definition of tragedy, that man has failings and is aware of them and is led to self-destruction. In Macbeth's case, he pulls a lot of people along with him, which is very unfortunate. But it's a beautiful role. This is kind of a once-in-a-lifetime chance to do this. Myself, I do have Scottish roots. I'm actually related to Malcolm, because the Malcolm McCallum clan are one and the same. So here I'm playing the adversary of my own clan. But I'm just thrilled to be able to explore this. The poetry in the play is just amazing. It's really a beautiful play. There were witch scenes with the witches that were inserted into the play a century after Shakespeare, trying to turn it into the, you know, Macbeth the musical.
Really? Yes, so the Hecate scenes in the play were probably written by Middleton, who was a Jacobean playwright. And so we've cut the scenes that are not Shakespeare's. My surmise is that there are scenes missing in the play. That you can argue till the cows come home.
Scholars do.
And they do. They love to. I think one of the things that's most interesting that people do tend to ignore is that one of the first acts in the play, the first thing that happens, is that Duncan orders the execution of someone who has been a loyal follower because of a rebellion. Now, that indicates that A, the kingdom is not at peace, and B, Duncan is a ruthless king. And on the hearsay of one man orders another man's execution. That's sort of where we launched our idea, that our interpretation comes from that first act of violence.
Now, you, Cedar, play Malcolm, the son of the king. What is the nature of your character?
Malcolm's very, very spoiled. You know, he has everything handed to him. You know, he's been taught that he's going to be the rightful heir to the throne since he was a very, very young child. And he has all this, you know, nobleness training, which, you know, affects everything about the character, about how he moves, about how he walks, about how he talks. For me, I have to just assume that he's the smartest one in the play, because he's cocky and he thinks he's smarter than everyone else, and he's a politician.
And so, despite being spoiled, he's a smart guy.
Yeah. I mean, he's had, you know, every kind of education at the time was given to him, because he's going to be the future ruler of the country. And, you know, he really doesn't take it for granted, really, you know. He believes he is endowed by God to lead these people on one level. You know, he also knows he has to be smarter and stay a step ahead of everyone else, because, especially in the play, you know, my father just dies, is murdered, and so obviously I'm the next target. And everyone thinks I did it, at some given point, thanks to Macbeth over here. But yeah, it's a great piece of drama. I love working with the Arden players, and it's a blast.
Now, Lady Macbeth, archetypal, what would you say, bad lady?
Yes, I mean, I think she's a creature of her times. In a warrior society, women have choices. They can either be meek and submissive, as Lady Macduff is, and she dies, or they can do what Lady Macbeth does, which is she asks to be unsexed. She becomes a man, or tries to be.
Meanwhile, faking her meek tenderness at times.
Oh, yes. I think, ironically, one scholar pointed out that the Macbeth marriage is the best marriage in all of Shakespeare.
Oh, my goodness.
They actually do love each other, and they do support each other,
yeah.
Which you don't find almost anywhere else,
isn't
even in the comedies. And that also is part of our interpretation of the witches, which is a little unorthodox. Our witches are the thanes' wives who go to the forest to communicate with the old religion, which is where their power comes from. Because this warrior society that professes on the surface to be Christian does not allow them to have any place in it with any power. So our witches are ladies who go to the woods, go to nature, and go back to the old religion.
What is the role of the witches? It's a very interesting thing that they do, which is they prophesy the action of the whole play. Macbeth knows it, but then the question is, when there's a prophecy, do you take those prophecies into your own hands, or do you let life and destiny fulfill them all by itself?
Ah, well, predestination. And that's interesting, because there's always, in the 16th century, there was that Catholic-Protestant question about predestination. Mm. I think that they are seers. There is a tradition in Scotland of second sight, of people who are gifted with seeing into the future, the Cassandra complex. And so we've taken our cue from that. They don't make things happen. They do prophesy. They open up ideas within the people they talk to. And inspire them, perhaps in a not so good a way, but...
Well, that's the thing. I mean, they don't make it... The witches don't make the prophecy happen, but then Macbeth says, oh, I'm going to be king. Okay, I better kill
exactly.
the...
Yes.
You know.
Yes. Yes. The power of suggestion. They look into the future and they say, oh, and by the way, Banquo's sons are going to be king, and so Macbeth says, oh, my God, I've got to kill Banquo. You know, it's... It's how human beings deal with the information that the play centers and deals with, I think.
So how do you see and interpret your character, Lady Macbeth?
I think she loves him very much. I think she also is ambitious for herself and for him. She sees a path before them that's been laid out, which he tells her about in the beginning of the play in a letter. And she tries to facilitate it. And then when she sees him disintegrating and falling into more and more murder, I think she realizes that they're lost, he's gone out of control. The same evil that pulls him into a spire of destruction pulls her down too, and she finally just collapses.
Guilt and remorse are themes as well as all this cruelty that goes on.
Oh, certainly. What's so extraordinary is, I know it's very fashionable to play Macbeth as this evil, one-sided villain, all darkness, but the language doesn't indicate that. In many ways, he does more self-examination and self-questioning than Hamlet does. His speeches are constantly full of, can I do this, should I do this, perhaps I shouldn't, what am I doing to myself, what am I doing to the world around me, what am I doing to my country even. You know, when he finds out about Lady Macbeth's illness, he turns to the doctor and says, can you heal my country? If he were a total villain, he wouldn't even care. So I think I try always, everything we do or comes organically from the text, and I think that's an interesting thing to concentrate on.
One of the things I love about seeing Shakespeare plays is that you realize what the origin of a lot of the English language clichés are.
Yes.
So the two that I got last night were the milk of human kindness, mm-hmm. and the be-all and the end-all.
Oh, yes.
Those come from, who knew?
Yeah.
So we have to talk about that every time you come on.
Oh, sure.
What are those? But I mean, that said, Elizabethan English is, it is what it is. It's interesting for an audience member who really doesn't know the vocabulary or can't remember it back from high school, you get the play anyhow, even though you don't understand half the words.
Well, my feeling is that if the actors understand what they're saying, and if they're in the moment and they act the role and they're convincing as the characters dealing with each other, the audience will understand it. If the actors know what they're saying, the audience will know what they're saying.
It's a vast memorization task as well.
It is for Macbeth. It is for Argos.
Well, I've been working on it for a few months, and the more I get into the language, in a way, the more I get lost, because there are so many facets, there's so much subtlety, there's so many ways to look at his speeches.
And therefore to speak them.
And to speak them, yes. So it's quite a treasure trove. A lot of themes repeat through the play. One of the questions that Macbeth tackles from the beginning to the end is, what is it to be a man? The question comes up all the time. Another is sleep. Once he's shed the blood of Duncan, he realizes immediately that he will never really, really sleep again until the final sleep. And then the question again of blood that I brought up earlier. He's dealing in oceans of blood, and he says, "Should I wade no more in the blood, returning to where I was before, as tedious as going over to the end?" So he's caught. He's really caught, and he has no choice but to descend in this spiral of this vortex of destructiveness, even though he's painfully aware moment by moment that he's not morally or spiritually right.
It's interesting because he thinks of this as necessary killing. He thinks of this as killing that he must do.
Because of the prophecy?
Because of where he believes he must be. It is his job and his fate and his destiny to be king, and therefore, in order to preserve that and to get there, he must do these acts. It reminds me a little bit of friends of mine and my own father who've been in combat and had to kill. And the first kill is the one that is self-destructive. The next one, at least from people I've talked to, is different. And then there is the residual guilt of having taken lives, even when you had no choice and you were told to do so and it was your job to do so. It does still affect your soul, and I think we deal with that in this play on an extreme level. But what death and destruction does to the human soul is, I think, what the play is about.
Yeah, exactly. Macbeth is on the battlefield at the beginning of the play,
yes.
And he's a hero.
He's just
he's
come
doing
back
his
from
job.
Battle.
But when he takes the life of Duncan, it's a totally, totally different thing to stick the dagger in the sleeping man, and he goes into total shock. It's just he can't believe what he's done.
And meanwhile has to pretend and equivocate to the rest of the world and pretend that it's a big surprise.
Right.
Yes, exactly. And then there's the issue of Macduff, who's a fascinating character, wonderfully played by Franklin Cunico, who, you know, wants to be the loyal, the great warrior, and yet he leaves to do what he thinks is the right thing and abandons his wife and children to be murdered. Now, that didn't happen in history. Shakespeare wrote that in the play and changed history for a reason. What Macduff says is, I brought this on myself. The repercussions of our actions.
Now, Deborah, you've been in theater since, I don't know for how long, but for many, many years.
More than I want to count.
And I assume this is a play that you've come back to more than once, and I'm wondering what it's like. I love reading books or plays that I had to read in high school and had, you know, very little understanding of at the time, and then come back. What's it like to come back to this play? How do you see it anew?
I think every time, you know, in every stage in your life, you see something different in it. When you're younger, you see one thing. When you're, at your prime, you see another. And when you're lumping into middle age. You see it in another way.
What? Our prime is over? I thought we were just getting started.
I'm talking about me, not you. I've also taught the play as a teacher. One of the things that I always feel when I teach the play is I wish my students could see it on the stage, could see it played, because it's such a vibrant play. And it's hard for, you know, American students today to read something and see how it comes off the page, which is one of the reasons we do a special student deal that student groups get in for $5 and the teachers come free. And we've had a number of student groups sign up because I want as many students as possible to come and see it on the stage played.
Are you a student, Cedar, in Santa Fe?
I am. I go to the College of Santa Fe. I'm studying for my BFA in acting and theater.
So did you read this play in high school? Is this the second time around for you?
Yeah, I definitely studied it in high school in English class, you know, and it was very formal, and, you know, it's like sort of like the teacher makes everyone read the play together to make sure they're actually reading it and get the scenes that they are exposed to. And, it's very different to actually do it and perform it, or to even see it done, because it really can come together a lot more, I think, in young people's heads as like a full piece of work and not just a laborious task having to go through the old English, which,
right,
if you're exposed to for a long enough period of time, actually becomes very easy.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So we're talking about Macbeth, produced by the Arden Players. Is this your fourth year?
This is our third year in our third production.
And it opens on Friday, March 28th at El Museo Cultural at 8 in the evening, and it runs for several weekends. There's Sunday matinees at 2 o'clock.
Sunday matinees at 2, and we have a special matinee on the 5th of April on a Saturday, which will include a discussion of the play and the production after it.
And that there's going to be an Elizabethan scholar there who,
yes,
taught at St. Andrews University in Scotland.
Yes, the one that William went to.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that should be tremendous fun. And for more information, people can call
983-4002.
983-4002. And Deborah Dennison is the director, and she is Lady Macbeth. Argus McCallum is Macbeth himself, and Cedar Brosh is Malcolm. I want to thank you all so much for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Zaylee Pollan. She is a journalist and photographer, and she was in Iraq in 2003 and again in 2005, and is here to talk with us about some of her work and the 5th anniversary, good heavens, of the invasion of Iraq. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be back here. We've spoken about Iraq with you a couple times, and I'm so sorry we're here at yet another year talking about what's going on there. I think it's pretty appropriate we're following Macbeth, because
it is just weirdly appropriate that we're following Macbeth.
It's definitely a different kind of photo exhibit that I've done in the past, and I just feel like people need to really reckon with what's happening there. So the photos that SFAI and Diane Karp have agreed to show and were really enthusiastic to show are quite gruesome. It's about a suicide bombing for the most part, and I just wanted people to really acknowledge what Iraqis are living with every day, and also what U.S. soldiers are living with every day in terms of the psychological trauma, in terms of the visuals that they're coming back with. It was a difficult exhibit for me to pull together, more difficult than any other, I think, talk or exhibit that I've done. So I am struggling with it this fifth year.
So the Santa Fe Art Institute, which is on the campus of the College of Santa Fe, is going to be showing your work indoors, projected images, and then at night, after dark, they're also going to be projecting a slideshow on the side of the building. Is that correct?
Exactly. Every day from 9 to 5 inside in a projection room, and then outside on the wall from sundown to dawn to dusk, basically. I think that's going to be incredibly powerful, and that's really what I wanted. I think that the outdoor art and the outdoor scenery is really how I wanted that to be conveyed, so I'm excited about that.
So since you went to Iraq, you have become a mother. You have a beautiful little one-year-old who's running around the cafe with Diane right now. You were recently going through the images, the pictures that you took when you were in Iraq, and suddenly they look different to you.
Yeah, I was looking through images, and some of which, particularly this one I'm thinking about, I've seen 100 times. It's a picture of a woman in Najaf washing a dead baby. They wash and then they swaddle the bodies before they bury them. This one happened to be maybe a 5-6-year-old girl. again, I've seen it hundreds of times, and yet looking through it, I felt as if someone had punched me in the stomach. I think being a mother, I just felt so protective, and of course you can't help but have that reaction, what if that was my son? And then going through other images, and this one suicide bombing happened to be at a school bus, and there were lots of kids and young bodies and young body parts. And again, that thought of, my God, what if that was my child? And not only what if that was my child there, but what if that was my child witnessing that? What if that was the reality that my child was growing up with every day? We have someone like Tipper Gore complaining about lyrics on record labels, and which is good, we should be aware of that. But look at what these children are living with. The kind of post-traumatic stress they're dealing with is going to be astronomical. So this kind of this generational thing. We're kind of destroying a generation, not just...
And I mean, the idea that, and you've said this on some of the text in your show, is you're raising a whole generation of traumatized children who are going to need tremendous amounts of rehabilitation, which may or may not be available to them.
You know, I mean, there's so many psychologists, too. I had so much difficulty actually finding statistics about children in Iraq, even calling places of Save the Children. I said, you know, how many are dead? And they say, oh, well, these are figures that we count after the war, which I thought was incredible. There are some studies...
So if the war goes on forever, then the numbers never get, basically never get counted.
Exactly. We just won't acknowledge that there are children that are dying every day. One organization called War Child says one child every 5 minutes dies in Iraq. I don't know where that comes from. But the trauma and the psychologists that are in Iraq, if they're still in Iraq, and there are very few who are there, many have fled, many have been killed, are dealing with this trauma and saying that there really is no help. I think 95% of the children, one of these studies, wasn't getting any help. And some have severe PTSD. One doctor was saying, you know, whenever there's a bomb, this girl starts screaming uncontrollably. Another small boy starts hitting his mother violently. And there's nothing he can do. So this, you have the children in Iraq, but you also have the soldiers. I mean, this is what we need to acknowledge. And a lot of the images here, for me, one of the most extraordinary things about this particular suicide bombing was how I could watch my mind shut down to be able to witness it and to be able to take photos of that. And this was done in just one afternoon. I had seen bombings before, but not with so many kids. So I think that's what was so difficult. And so imagining the soldiers where they're day in and day out, how they shut down, and then they're just supposed to open up when they come back. It was incredible to watch my mind do that.
So you were in Iraq as a journalist, and you were, there's a photograph in the exhibition that's going to be at the Santa Fe Start Institute starting today of some, I think, pilgrims standing in a line waiting for something to happen. You go around the corner for a second, next thing you know, there's been a suicide bombing just a few feet away from where you were standing.
So we got a call. I was actually on patrol. I was embedded with a military unit that I was actually training Iraqi soldiers. So we get a call, and we could hear the explosion. We come around the corner, the smoke is going, the car is there, and I started shaking. We got out of the Humvee, and the first thing I saw was children on the street, and I thought, this is not going to be good. Then we have to clear the streets, and what's difficult is that when there's a suicide bombing, very often the strategy is that you go to a car or you go to help people who are in the streets, and other car bombs go off. So you start running, and of course, as a journalist, it's should I put everything down? Should I help people? Should I? And I realized fairly quickly there were not many people who could be helped at that point. So,
and you're probably of more help taking the photographs than trying to offer rescue work anyway.
I'd like to think so. I'd like to think so. Just a brief aside, I've been thinking recently because of my son that maybe I didn't want to deal with war anymore. I didn't want the imagery in my psyche right now. And a friend of mine said, yeah, but if you don't tell these stories, if you don't show these images, who's going to? I think more and more soldiers are stepping up, for example, the ones you've had on your show, and I think that they're...
And the many brave people who have spoken out in the Winter Soldier investigations, which happened over the last weekend and who are featured on Democracy Now! Every
exactly.
day.
Exactly, and they're amazing, and their stories are heartbreaking. And I think more and more this is happening. It's been kind of slow, a slow build-up, but that's fantastic. And if they can do it, they're the ones who are also living there and who are doing that, and I hope to pass that on. But it's true, but somebody saying that, you know, know, who is going to show these images? How are people here going to mark the fifth anniversary of Iraq? You know, they'd rather believe that the surge is fantastic and we hardly have a war anymore. There's somebody on Fox News said the other day, a kind of a fragile peace, I think they said. It's like, what does a fragile peace mean? There's only one car bomb every 3 days instead of every day? It's incredible to me. And when you have 2 million refugees, again, there are fewer people to kill. I don't know.
We're talking to Zaylee Pollan, whose work is being shown starting today at the Santa Fe Art Institute on the campus of the College of Santa Fe. It'll be indoors from 9 to 5 and then outside projected on the wall from dusk until dawn every day. Another thing that you point out is that children like to gather around all these disaster areas and look at what's going on. You saw that as well.
That's one of the photos, too, that made a big impression on me. And, of course, it's hard to convey a scene there. You can look at the photos, and in a sense, they're one-dimensional. What you can't get is the smell and the noise. And at one point, we all had to take cover because one of the cars was full of ammunition, and you have all this small arms fire just shooting randomly out of this car. So you can't get that, and you can't see these kids walking along, you know, among the body parts. Just look at them, they're curious, they're onlookers. It's like rubbernecking here. And so a photo I have is of a crowd once the Iraqi soldiers had finally pulled them back. And I must note, the Iraqi soldiers that we were with were so terrified of the bomb, they ran and hid. And I actually followed other soldiers to go and get them and pull them out onto the street and say, no, this is your country, you have to do this. And they were terrified and they were overwhelmed. And the one photo of a soldier that is actually the ad for the photo exhibit, he just sat down and just started sobbing. And the American soldiers kind of, you know, said, never mind, let's keep going. But there was nothing they can do. I mean, it's so overwhelming, so overwhelming.
One of the things that struck me about that photograph of the Iraqi soldier with his head bowed, weeping, sitting on the sidewalk, was that you didn't know what nationality he was. You can't see his face or any identifying characteristics. He's in military uniform, and you suddenly realize all soldiers are just soldiers, and they're all experiencing the same horror, whether they be on this side or that side.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I think for the Iraqis, in a way, it's even more profound because this is their country, and they're realizing what's happening. They're seeing these are their people, their children who are watching. I mean, when I went by the bus, I was taking a picture, and somebody ran up and said, "This is my son." And you look down, and there are these legs, all these children's legs. And I realized it wasn't necessarily this man's son, though it may have been. It's the children of Iraq who were suffering in this car bombing and in every car bombing. And I really started to feel that talking to soldiers afterwards as well. I mean, the ones, the Iraqi translators, even the ones who had worked with Americans and who were used to this a little bit more, were so exhausted at the end of this day. I have one picture that's actually not in this exhibit, though, of one of the translators climbing into a Humvee and just staring at the backseat, and he just couldn't even move. And, you know, the Americans, we all, they were doing their own kind of self-protection, and they start joking about barbecues and this, and they have to. I mean, otherwise I think you'd really kind of go insane. As obscene as that sounds, you have to do that kind of self-preservation. So everyone does it their own way. The Iraqis, yes, were more emotional. The soldiers were less likely to go and sit and sob on the side of the road.
Another thing that comes up in your show is that in addition to the actual violent death that's happening all the time because of the war, because of the invasion, there's chronic malnutrition among both adults and children.
There's just this escalation of a lot of different things. Malnutrition, one of the studies that I read in some households, as much as 33%. So you have like one in three children who is not getting enough food. This is obscene. I mean, oddly enough, this probably wouldn't have happened under Saddam Hussein because he continued giving food rations. There are a number of outbreaks of different illnesses because the water isn't clean. A lot of children simply aren't getting educated. I think one of the statistics I have is that 50% are not going to school.
This is a very educated population.
Incredibly educated. I mean, I hardly met anyone, and we just had selected people randomly on the street who did not at least have a BA, if not a master's. And this was very important in Iraq. So, incredibly educated, and these kids are simply not going to school. Parents are terrified. Would you want to send your child to school when you don't know when the next bombing is going to be? And some of these crazy people have even targeted schools to make more of an impression. I mean, it's really extraordinarily frightening.
The photographs that you took, Zaylee, in 2003 and 2005, one could say, well, you know, they're outdated now, but it seems like they're not. I mean, these scenes are still happening.
Mary Charlotte, I wish it was outdated. I really, really do. And in fact, it's gotten worse. I mean, when I took these photos, things were just, in 2005, it was really just escalating to the state that it is now, or maybe now they say there's this peace, quote unquote. But no, these car bombs are happening all the time. Violence is actually growing in Iraq. The kind of violence against people, if it's not a car bomb, it's the threat of kidnapping for ransom, because the economic insecurity is so intense. The kind of corruption is so intense on the streets of Iraq. This is not outdated. This is merely an old-fashioned view of what's happening all the time now.
Have you ever been tempted to go back?
No. It was so difficult to work the last time I was there, and it was really hard to get as much information as I wanted. And also to work with Iraqis, which is what I wanted to do most, you put them in danger, in such intense danger. So a number of my friends that I stay in contact with have fled or are still working there, having a difficult time. But it was too much for me to put the people that I cared for in danger there, or even strangers if I hired somebody else. So no, I mean, if it's a different country, I can't help but think of Iraq every single day. I mean, my son is Iraqi. Will he ever be able to go and see a country of his father? I don't know. I don't know if that will ever happen. And it breaks my heart.
We're talking to Zaylee Pollan. So the slideshow that you have is both text that you've written and photographs that you took. You were there primarily as a print journalist. Who knew that you were such a good photographer? These are really great photographs.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I would consider myself first a journalist as well. But when you're there, and even as a journalist working there, I realized how powerful the images are, for sure. And these images, and again, I haven't shown most of these images because they were too horrible. They're kind of images that, and this I must say, this is the edited version. So
this is the worst images removed version?
Right.
Why not show it for what it is?
You know, there's some images that just, they gave me nightmares afterwards. And in fact, there's some images I couldn't even take. I mean, when the man is showing me these little feet sticking out from the bus, it was incredible what I did. I looked at him and I couldn't take the picture. I couldn't take it. I remember looking up into the bus, looking at the steering wheel, and suddenly it's as if the kind of soft focus came into focus, and I see the bus driver's head behind the wheel. And then my mind says, okay, no, we can't really deal with that either, although I did take a photo of that. I go down, I just look down to try to get my head away from body parts, and I see a pile of Iraqi dinar on the ground. And it was the most surreal moment. I became completely obsessed with this pile of money on the ground and thinking, I wonder how much that is. I wonder if I could pick it up and put it in my pocket. I wonder who it belongs to. And I realized afterwards it's really the brain's way of saying, I need to protect you from this. We need to escape this for a second, even if it's just, I was probably only there for a moment. It felt like 10 minutes. And so in that sense, I also don't want a lot of other people really jarred by it. I mean, these images are jarring. You'll see them. You don't have to get, I don't want it to become gratuitous. I want it to be real. I want people to see what's going out there, and they're not easy images. They're very surreal. It's very odd. There's a picture of a head in the middle of the street.
That's the one that stuck with me, I have to say.
It's striking. It's striking, and you can't. Your mind says, "Well, I wonder where the body is, and I wonder how that got there, and what? Yeah, why was it there when I was taking the
photo?" And how long is it going to sit there before something is done, and by whom, and what?
Exactly. That was one of the last bodies too that they cleaned up, and I remember being there at the end of the day and screaming, like, "Who is going to get this head out of the street? This is killing me."
Another thing that you talk about in the exhibition is that there are so many people who are looking for missing relatives.
Mm-hmm. And that's a story that a lot of, maybe not a lot, but I've seen journalists do recently too, because it's just so horrible that they're looking for missing relatives and they can't, so they search these morgues that are just overflowing. And the Iraqi government, at one point, I think that was closed it off, they won't let journalists go anymore. because there's just so many and it's so horrific. And just the sight and the sounds of these family members searching. I mean, there was one story a BBC journalist did. A man goes every single week through the morgue looking for his father. Every single week. And I think that's when the government said, no journalists, we don't really want you to do this. So the kind of editing going on by the Iraqi government at this point is fairly severe as well.
Zaylee Pollan is a journalist and photographer. She was in Iraq in 2003 and 2005, and starting today at the Santa Fe Art Institute, her images, a slideshow of her work, will be projected at the Art Institute indoors during the day, and then from sundown until dawn the next day at night on the side of the Santa Fe Art Institute, which is on the campus of the College of Santa Fe. If you go into the College of Santa Fe and just keep driving straight and get to the very end, the building on your left is it. Zaylee Pollan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I hope people really do get to see this exhibit. Thank you all.
We're going to take a little break right now. Please stay tuned. We're going to be talking about Global Dance Fest in just a moment. I'd like to welcome now, joining us by telephone, Marjorie Nesset with the Global Dance Fest 2008. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This is the eighth year of Global Dance Fest. Tell us about this festival.
Well, as you said, it started 8 years ago. The idea was to bring dance to New Mexico that simply wasn't available here. Contemporary dance, but work that comes from other cultures and other geographic locations in the world. So the emphasis has always been on international work and on work that's a little newer, a little more reflects the environment that it's being made in, so that it's very present in the community.
Now, this year, it's African dance. Where do the dancers come from? There's a tremendous diversity of African dance and music.
There is. We titled it Journeys Africa because we started with someone, Ron K. Brown, whose work very much reflects something of the American South. And then last weekend, Reggie Wilson, who connects both the South and the African heritage, and who has many members of his company that are from many African countries. Now, coming up this weekend, we have Andrea Wamba, who grew up in Congo Brazzaville but lives in Senegal, and Nora Chipamara, who's grew up in Zimbabwe and currently lives in New York and works with Urban Bush Women and does her own work. Then next week, Aisha Mubarak and Hafiz Daou are from Tunisia. And finally, Julie Dosavi and other musicians and dancers. Julie grew up in France but is of Benin heritage and connects back with her country and with Africa a great deal, even though France is her formal home. So it's quite a variety, kind of covers the continent in a way.
And this is all happening in Albuquerque. Normally we don't cover too much of Albuquerque, but since our signal is starting to go down there and since this is such a great festival, it's taking place at the South Broadway Cultural Center and the North 4th Art Center. Is that correct?
Right. For the most part, the first event was South Broadway Cultural Center, and then the rest of them are at the North 4th Art Center, North 4th Theater in the corner of 4th and Griegos.
So in addition, there is an exhibition of photography. Tell us about that.
Well, this is a wonderful exhibition, actually. Antoine Tempe, who's French and American, has lived in the U.S. for many years now, gave up his job a number of years ago as a stockbroker and decided to do what he really cared about and started traveling in Africa and taking photographs of African artists. And in this case, particularly African dancers. So there's an amazing exhibit. There are portraits that Antoine has taken over the past few years, and several of the people are performing in our festival, and several we've actually presented in the past. So it's both very international and sort of personal for us as well.
And there's also films. There's some African films.
We have something on Saturday called In Context. We just invented it this year, actually. And we start at 10 o'clock Saturday morning with a film. And it's a film, most of them are from Africa, but they're films the artists who are performing have actually selected that have meant a lot to them in their careers and their own journeys. And so there's a real variety, but they're wonderful films. That's at 10. And then at noon, we have the artists who are here that weekend come in, and there's a discussion, a sort of panel, open discussion with people who come by. We have lots of food, and it's intended to be very casual but informative and meaningful at the same time. So we tell people they can come in their pajamas and drink coffee and watch a movie.
One of the things I have to say I appreciate about African music and African dance is that African dancers and musicians so easily and very gracefully assimilate the music and instruments and forms of other countries and of other traditions and really make it their own. And that's something I think you see in this. It's not just pure African folkloric dance.
Oh, no, this isn't folkloric at all. But you're absolutely right. You see the traditions and the heritage reflected in the work, just like we all, you know, work in our immediate contemporary environment, but we're still influenced by our families and our birthplaces and so forth. So, no, you're very much right.
So all of this is happening coming up this weekend. Tell us about the North Forth Arts Center.
Well, North Forth Arts Center has three main components. One is we have a strong educational program working both with adults with developmental disabilities and with the community, young people in the community. We have artists and teachers, AmeriCorps volunteers out at the community centers, and work with people who want to make art but struggle with mental health issues and a variety of concerns. And then we have the theater, which reflects a little of all of that. Global Dance Fest is particularly focused on geographic regions in the contemporary world. We have a festival in the fall, Out of the Ordinary, which brings artists from all over the world, but it's a little more, the work is a little more centered on social issues and rather than geographical regions so much. And then, of course, we have our gallery. It's run by these wonderful AmeriCorps volunteers who bring the community really into that gallery and work with artists in the community. So we have a variety of shows that kind of reflect that breadth. So we're about education. We're about people having the opportunity to present their work. We're about being out there in the community and working with people. So it's a real, it has a lot of breadth and depth, I guess I want to say.
Marjorie Nesset is with Global Dance Fest 2008, and for more information, you can look on the web at vsartsnm.org or just Google Global Dance Fest Journeys Africa. Marjorie Nesset, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thanks so much. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening. Thank you. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte, and we have a treat tomorrow. Bill Burke-White, our foreign correspondent, will be back with us after trips to places all over the world, which we will hear about, and much, much more here on Santa Fe's only public radio station, KSFR. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.